back at this, and we talked about it. And they finally said, well, what you're numbering the alphabet in reverse, and the letters are numbers. And that's all there was to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the three underprivileged children came up to the front of the class, and I started to use the same approach with him. And one girl said to the other girl, oh, she said, I don't care anything about learning how to spell love like that. She said, do you care anything about spelling love like that? She said, who needs to know how to spell love? She said, I watched television last night with Eartha Kitt, and she sang, oh, she sang such a pretty song. I just love that song. She said, didn't you love that song that she sang? And this other girl said, oh, I just love that song. And I said, well, what was it she sang? And, oh, she said, what was the name of that song she sang? And the two of them talked back and forth, and finally she said it was a certain song. And I said, well, how do you know? Oh, the word we were going to spell was listen. She said she didn't need to know how to spell listen or to know how to listen. So I said, well, what was that? What was the song? She told me the name of it, and I said, well, how do you know that's the song? Well, that's what he said it was. I said, well, how do you know that's what he said it was? She said, well, I heard it. I said, well, how did you hear it? Well, she said, I listened to him, and I heard him, and that's what he said. I said, you did listen. She said, yes, listen. And I said, well, that's what this word is, listen. So then he stopped me right away. He said, you've gotten off the subject. And I said, well, I don't agree with you. I haven't gotten off the subject because I just made her understand that you do listen. She does need to know how to listen, and this is listen. But he stopped the class right there because he said, you got me. And I said, well, I don't know what you would do then if you didn't pursue it that way, because they were not going to do it any other way. You know, they were going to talk about Eartha Kitt the rest of the class. So he said, well, you just would stop and do something else. And I said, well, I don't mean I'd take the whole day trying to convince them that they wanted to learn how to spell listen, but I would pursue it a little while, just as I had done. So different people came up with different things, and one boy kept being very critical about it. So I said, well, what would you have done? Well, he said, first of all, these underprivileged children, these black people, usually this is what they mean when they say underprivileged children, these black people don't behave that way. He said, one of my friends in Washington asked me to substitute one day for a class, and he said, he told me ahead of time that there were a bunch of smart alecks, and they didn't want to learn, and they wouldn't cooperate, and they wouldn't do anything I wanted them to do. So he said, I was prepared for it. So he said, I went in and I said to them, now I've been told that you're a bunch of smart alecks and you don't want to learn and you won't listen. And he said, I'm just giving you the warning right now. When I start, there's going to be no nonsense. So he said most of them listened and behaved pretty well. But there was one big, tall, black boy in the class who just kept making little remarks, and when he went back near him, he gave him a shove. And he said, I just told him if he shoved me again, I'd knock him clear across the room. And I meant it. So Dr. Cecil Wine said, you know, he said, it's people like you who make me fear that someday my house will be burned to the ground. Just people acting like this. So we had a long discussion about the way black people should be treated, especially, and how this is not the way to solve a problem in a classroom and all of that. But he finally came around to saying that I had been honest in saying that that's what I would do, and that was the only thing I knew to do, and what else could be done. And he said there'll be many times in a classroom situation when you don't really know what to do. Nobody's given you any answers for it. And you'll have to solve it the best you can. But at least you're honest about it, and that's the important thing. And if you realize that the situation will arise when you're not always going to be in control, then that's half the battle.
Now that was your psychologist,
right? That was a psychologist professor.
Yeah. And he had, let me see, I forgot now what the problem was.
Well, he had asked us the first day of school, because There were so many in the class. He had only expected 15, and there were 30. So the first day he said, well, since I can't do what I'd really planned to do, let's just sort of start the discussion by saying, by talking about these uprisings and things that are going on campus. And I don't remember exactly what I said to him, but I sort of ended my whole conversation by saying that I didn't really mind the long hair or the blue jeans or anything else if they were clean. What did bother me was that I couldn't tell the boys from the girls. But I would be glad when we got back to the stage of being able to tell a boy from a girl. Other than that, it didn't bother me. I had no intention of being that way, and I hoped my son wouldn't ever be that way. But as long as they were clean, it didn't bother me. And we were talking about marriage and love, and I just said that I thought people fell in love and they got married and they had certain goals they worked towards. Different people had different goals. Some things were important to some people and other things were important to others, but that I thought real marriages were founded on love. And then I thought a lot of the young people had been disillusioned about all of this, and that some of the things that we had set up standards for had sort of fallen apart and had not proved worthy of the importance we had given them, and they were just sort of rebelling about a lot of the traditional things. But that I thought love, as long as people felt loved and their love for one another, that things would work out. So he sort of shivered, you know, put his hands across his chest and shivered and looked at me and was sort of a look of disdain, I thought. I interpreted it that way anyway. And he said, every time you talk, I just get cold shivers. You're just hung up on love. And I know an awful lot of people who don't know the meaning of the word love, and they're married. And I said, well, I don't. And I prefer to keep my belief about it. I said, I'm not naive enough to believe that there aren't marriages of convenience and there are marriages for different things, but I said, I prefer to think that the main reason for it is for love.
Well, now, where did the listen come in? I forgot that.
Oh, you missed all that?
No, I didn't miss it. I mean.
Explaining the word.
We
were trying to teach. He was trying to demonstrate the difference in teaching underprivileged children,
yeah,
and the smart children.
Yeah.
And how you can't always give the underprivileged children an incentive to want to learn, or you can't get them to learn what you think they should learn. You have to reverse your thinking about it. And these three girls played this part very well, because I think each one of them had taught either in Harlem or in a public school in Manhattan where they had this kind of student to teach. And I know there are students like that, but I had never taught some who weren't very bright. But I was supposed to teach each of the groups how to spell stop, look, and listen,
yeah,
with numbers instead of words.
Uh-huh.
And the smart ones came up and they wanted to learn. They were interested in learning how, and they looked at the numbers and they tried to figure out how the numbers were being used. And by discussing it and looking at the words and asking questions, they figured out that we had simply given the letters of the alphabet numbers, starting at the end of the alphabet with number one, and that's the way the words were spelled. But the underprivileged children, or these black children, if you will, didn't want to learn. They said they didn't have to learn how to spell listen. They didn't need to know how to spell listen.
Yeah.
There was no reason for it at all.
Yeah.
And they started talking about television and what they'd heard and so on and so forth. So I was just trying to get them to realize that when they were watching television, they were listening.
Yeah.
If they had not been listening, they wouldn't have known what Eartha Kitt sang.
Yeah.
And they would not have been able to appreciate it.
Yeah.
If they weren't listening. And when I started off on this tangent, the teacher stopped me and said,
yeah,
now you're getting off the...
Well, why would he call that a tangent? Looks like that'd be just a kiss.
Well, that's what I thought too. So that's what I said to him. I said, well, I don't know how else, how would you get them to finally learn how to spell listen if you didn't convince them this way that they did need to know how to listen. He never did give us an answer. Different people in the class talked, but he never did give us an answer about it. So. But then that was later on, that was the class that I told you that he came in one day about the middle of the semester, and he said he was very disturbed about what was happening in the class, that it was, there was too much polarization.
And there was?
There was. But the class never was the same after that.
Oh.
Because everybody was careful about what they said. And those of us who had, I found that I didn't talk as much. And most of the ones who felt the way I did didn't talk as much.
Oh.
And even the ones who were quite liberal didn't express opinions as freely as they had before. Or if they expressed an opinion, they would try to excuse it.
Yeah.
And before they'd been very positive, they, you know, you'd say something, they'd say, oh no, that's not so at all. And they'd tell you, you know, what was so.
Oh.
But after he gave us this little talk about polarization, no one was quite the same in the class. We went on with our presentations and our lessons, but it was never quite the same.
So you could open it up a little bit better without the restraint.
Mm-hmm. If he hadn't said anything about polarization, we all realized, you know, that there were about two in the class that I could just never get to be, you know, say hello in a friendly way. I always spoke to everybody when I came in.
And you mean I should have any class?
There are about two in the class that I just never could. I walked in with one of the boys one day. He had been at Columbia during that rioting, and the girl had been a student at Berkeley. And they always sat together, and they were always very positive in their statements.
Yeah.
I said something to him like, it looks like it's going to be a pretty day today, and kind of smiled at him, you know. And he said, I guess so. And that was all he said. And we walked in together, and he went way over on the other side of the room and sat down, and I sat down about in the middle of the classroom. Everyone was aware of the difference of opinions of people, but they still said what they thought. But after Dr. Sisselhahn said that we were polarizing too much, no one behaved in quite the relaxed manner they had before.
Well, how do you account for that? Huh?
Well, I think...
You think it was that enabled them to see what they're doing?
I don't think they really knew what they were doing, actually.
I didn't realize so much.
I don't think they did. I don't think they knew what he meant when he said they were polarizing too much. Because I think each of them thought they were saying exactly what they felt.
Yeah.
And they thought that's what they should be doing. And they didn't realize when someone would make a statement and they'd sort of bark down their throats about it. They didn't realize that they were cutting off someone else's opinion too. What he was trying to get across to all of us, I think, was that we must be open to everybody's opinion and not try to force an opinion on anyone. Let them make their own decision about something. Present it, but let them make their decision about it.
Well,
I don't know. I've been away from it for so long that I felt a little bit I wasn't quite sure. But he had said to all of us that he said it would be very difficult, almost the first day, he said it would be very difficult for anybody to fail this course. So that, you know, I've never been in a class where a teacher said that.
Yeah.
I had no intention of failing because I knew that I could do well enough to pass.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that the very first day. But I was very surprised when I got my report card and he's given me an A. I'd done
you
a good job.
Man?
Yes, because
Because
my feeling from the way he reacted whenever I've made a comment about anything, my feeling was that he just sort of thought, well, you know, she is just so conservative and just so traditional and just so deep-seated in her little one little area that there's just no hope for her.
Yeah.
And he obviously didn't feel that way.
Well, you think you're...
I don't think so. I'm not... I know how I feel about things, but I am aware of the fact that other people can feel another way about it, and I like them just the same. I don't dislike people because they don't do or feel or react the same way I do about everything.
When you see yourself change position sometimes?
No, not very often. Not very often.
Yeah.
I guess, Guy, because I really have felt all of my life that I've sort of, well, I always think of Shakespeare and that quotation that we're all actors on stage. And I guess all of my life I've tried to convince people, or convince myself, that I'm as good as anybody else. And just because my father was terrific and I'm no good in one sense of the word, that doesn't mean that I'm not a worthless character. And I've tried all my life to do things too, because I have great respect for mother and for Gran and for our family. And I've never done anything knowingly to ever bring shame or embarrassment to anybody that I know. And I don't think I'm any better than anybody else. I don't mean that. And I'm not, and I'm aware of all of my shortcomings. But I've done the very best I could all of my life.
Consider your shortcomings.
Right. You know, God really didn't give us all, I could never sit down and play like Faye does, and I don't have the intellectual capabilities and things that you have. But if it's worth anything, I can keep a mighty nice home and cook a lot. And
I could never cook one turkey, much less 12.
It's not, you know, it's nothing, really.
Well,
it's nothing. And yet, no, my sisters can't do it. Mother couldn't do it. Didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
We never had a home that we could invite. Had a home that I could invite people into, because I never knew if Daddy was going to be there drunk and throwing things at Mother. And
you just a misfit according to your upbringing.
You should have been a rascalian.
No. But I don't mean that material things.
Yeah.
I don't mean that either.
Yeah.
Okay. No matter how much you have, there's always somebody who has more, and no matter how little one has, there's always somebody who has less.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I need to know one thing.
Okay.
When you all were knocking around Europe, you did just the same thing you did in Adirondack. You just lit out and looked around.
We didn't stay in any tourist places.
Oh.
And wouldn't let her buy any gimmicks.
we didn't buy any. No, we didn't. You know what we bought? We bought on our to come back home. We had to buy one of those old suitcases that fits on top of the other that you can strap together. Those expandable ones to bring back pamphlets and brochures and things we'd picked up, you know, all over the country.
Oh.
That's what we brought back. And pictures.
Yeah, literature.
But,
don't they, I remember in certain parts where I just have to, they have such nice things to read wherever you go.
They do.
You can go to Stratford or some little church that you never heard of before, and they'll have something nice to read on it. And we don't have anything.
those things a lot. The children would have to write reports or something in school, and we couldn't find anything really a little bit different. You know, you could always look in the World Book or Encyclopedia Britannica or something like that. But these little things that we brought back would have little special.
Well, now what was this little place about Joan of Arc was knighted there?
This little church. I've forgotten the name of it. Richard would remember it. We were driving through France. And, well, you know, we had this little old English car, and it didn't take any gasoline at all in it. You could just drive for days and days on one tank of gas. And, of course, you know, the countries over there, you can travel in great distances and cover two or three countries, where here you could just go through one or two states. But Richard had a fantastic ability to remember things, and he has always been interested in history.
Yeah.
And whenever we go to a country, he always remembers a lot about its history and about the people. And we drive all over looking for things that he remembered. And this particular day, we were just driving. I've forgotten where we were going, but Richard said, "We just ought to drive over and see that little church over there. That just might be the church where Joan of Arc was knighted." And we drove for hours in the pouring down rain to get over there. And it was exactly what it was. And we did that kind of thing all over the country. Well, and we'd always stay in the home of a family out in the countryside. And Richard would go into the hospital, and usually he worked or observed. Most of the places over there stopped about Friday at noon. And during the week while he was observing, I'd do all the sightseeing. And then everything that was, I thought was interesting and worthwhile and he should see, we'd go back to for him to see.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't anything special, why, we'd go on to something else. And we took, I think one of the things we enjoyed the most was, we took a trip from, Bergen, I guess, up to Narvik on the train. From Narvik up to Bergen. And going along, the train goes along the countryside there, along the fjords, and there's still the ships are still there in the fjords from World War I. World War II, I guess. They never moved them or anything. They're just sitting there and just half sunken into the fjords. And we went all the way up to the land of the midnight sun on those little hard benches that you sit on, you know, in the train, and they have seats like ours, and sat up all night long just watching looking at the
Well, now your hunches, tell me about another one of his hunches, that this was a church going to the heart of the United States. That seems incredible.
I can't think of any more right now.
Well, Ruth, was it more exciting over there, knocking around the countryside, than it was at home?
Yeah.
Because it's strange.
Because there's more history to it.
Yeah, and the history is more visible in that book.
Oh, you should. We sat in the Roman Forum and just tried to, you know, visualize all the things that were going on back during the days of Caesar.
Yeah.
Richard would like to just stay there, I think, a year.
But in every situation, he looked at the place, whether it was an Adirondack, that's
where. Yes, and he always saw things that, you know, we used to always say, the children would say, and I would say, how can you see so much and drive? And we weren't driving, and we wouldn't even see it.
Yeah.
Well, we might drive along, you know, and he'd say, did you see that pheasant? Where? What pheasant? We haven't seen a pheasant. Back the road a piece. Or a groundhog. Or walking through the woods, he'd see a certain kind of hole, and he'd say, now I wonder what made that hole. Or with the children, we'd see a beaver's dam. And we'd stand and watch and talk about why the dam was like that.
Did y'all ever run into anybody that you could learn from? I don't mean just isolated facts, but...
Well, I wasn't with Richard in Russia, but he told the story. He, I don't know how he got when he was there, people still were not allowed to talk, or they were afraid of being overheard. And he got one of these old Russian fellas, and Richard never drank. But he knew the only way he could get this fella to talk was to drink with him. And the other fellas tell the story that Richard sat up all night long with this Russian fella and drank with him, and they both got quite drunk. But Richard was alert enough to guide the conversation and get the answers to questions he wanted to know about Russia. And he was, now I wouldn't do that. I just would not get drunk for anything. But Richard wanted to get the information from this old fella, and he knew that's the only way he'd get it, because if the fella was alert and himself, he wouldn't do it because it might mean his life. And he sat and drank with him all night long to find out things he wanted to know. But he and Nick had sent me up, you know, when I came in. The reason I came in from the field was because Nick and Dick said that you and Faye had come back.
Yeah.
And I said, well, did they want me? And they said, well, they didn't know that you wanted me, but wasn't it about lunchtime? In other words, I should come in and help Faye get lunch ready.
Oh.
That was 2 hours ago.
Yeah. Sinful the way you trotted all over the round, all over the map like that.
I know, we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And another thing was,
I never trotted around anywhere like that.
What did you do when you were over there?
Well, stick to business.
I don't believe you, you know that.
Yes, sir.
I don't believe you.
Oh, no.
You did it in a different way, but I'm sure you didn't. Well, we went to,
Everything I've done, I've just had to get my nose
down
there.
I know.
I know, never, Roscoe Parker. He's been retired a long time. And I have never learned anything about the Middle Ages from him. He talks about Chaucer. Chaucer wrote a book. But he doesn't tell me what the book says.
That's right.
And I can't read Chaucer.
I don't know why people are like who know things are like that. I get so frustrated with people
who have the ability to read it. Does anybody else they sort of line it out for? Now, one of the things I do up here with the chaps I get, I line it out for them to get them started. Otherwise, they'll think of Franklin as some pompous old fellow who sings well of himself. And they will hang up on that. That'll scotch them. And I can get them through things like that. Well, I've never had anybody, it seems to me, like who could line things up for me and keep me from getting scotched.
You know, I can't think today, but you know those things that are on the floor that they do brass rubbings of? In the cathedrals and the churches.
Yeah.
Pretty calm.
I forget, but I know what's up.
Well, when Gary was over there last year, when he was in Cambridge last year, he usually just see small brass ovens. Mm-hmm. And he did two for us that are at least 6 feet tall. And I don't have a place to hang him. I feel so bad because he put so much. Down on, you know, if you sit down on your hands and knees and you have to do this. I told you about the time that we went to St. Andrews with the golf course. Yeah. And they said, well, there's no point in you going there because you never get into the clubhouse and you'd certainly never get on the golf course. That's all you had to say to Richard. You know, that something couldn't be done. That was just drawing nonsense. So we drove over there so he could see it. And he got out of the car and walked over toward the clubhouse. And about the time he got to it, this old gentleman came out. And they met on the steps. And they stood and talked about 30 or 40 minutes. The next thing I knew, they were disappearing in the door. Richard was gone about 2 hours. He came back out and he said, you don't mind waiting while I play a few holes of golf, do you? And I said, no, I certainly don't. So this old gentleman took him down to the golf course and he played. He just knew how to talk with the old gentleman, you know, who said whatever the magic word was, and he got right into the inner sanctum of the St. Andrews golf course.
He could.
Yeah. Well,
we have, when we left to go on our trip, we had Dr. Pat gave Richard a leather bound book of blank pages. To keep a record, a diary of the trip, and I have that at home. He didn't much like doing that, though. He didn't do it very long.
Yeah. Then you did fine.
Then I have one that I kept, but not in a leather bound. It was just in a little.
Now he mixed his own business with this.
Yes. Well, he was the first one to get this fellowship from the hospital. And normally what they do is send the fellows to one place to stay for a year. And Richard said, I won't go that way because I might get to a hospital and just waste a year. They may have nothing to offer. And he said, my time is too valuable and I won't do that.
Yeah.
But he said, if you'll give me a year and let me go to the different hospitals with the promise that I'll stay at the ones that have something to offer.
Genius in that, yes.
And he said, if they have anything to offer, I'll stay and get the information. But he said, I don't want to waste my time someplace with nothing.
Yeah.
So that's the way we went. And then he borrowed the money for me to go. his way was paid, and I went on borrowed money.
That's filthy here.
Yes, yes, sir.
And of course, after that, he just went every place.
He was all over many times.
I think one of the things he was the proudest, so proud of, was that he went into the backwaters of, I don't know if it's Idaho or Wyoming, I get confused. He did both things. But back in the country that not many people have been into, men have been into, they had they flew into a certain area, and then they they went by horseback a certain distance, and then they walked a certain distance to get into this countryside. And a friend of his up in Canada, who used to be a doctor, but he loved the countryside and doing this kind of thing so much, he gave up doctoring and went and is a guide now. And Richard went with him and with two other people who were photographers for Outdoor Life. And there's a whole article in one of the Outdoor Life magazines written up, and there's a picture of Richard with two of these other two fellows who went with him, and these big, great, big long fish that they caught, and telling about how difficult it is to get into this back country, and but how beautiful it is, and all that. He was so proud of having done that. And he did this in between. He spoke at a meeting in California, and in order to meet this friend who had turned guide, he had to do all sorts of things. There was no direct way to get from where he was to the place where Norm Merkley was to catch the plane, and he had to do all kinds of shenanigans to get there. And just barely made the flight, you know, each place. It just sounds like an unbelievable story.
Did you know Roger Karras? Mm-hmm. Well, he's an old personal friend of mine on the Today Show.
Roger Karras?
Yeah. He's not too old.
We used to watch that now. That was one of the
best. He's one of the best on the animal species and what else don't talk about. Mm-hmm. He's gifted, and he can talk, and so many of those people, you know, can't talk. Most of the things he says are unhappy, but he says it, you know, like all these species last time he was on, you know, we were talking about the other day, of the pests that were being introduced. And, you see, not too long ago, this little place out here was known, where the water is, it was known as Clearwater Pond. Well, and there was a house built up there where the old cistern's still there. And the, where the St. Augustine grass is, and up in that little clump of oaks, that's where they call it the old mansion house. Mm-hmm. And they had a little pier going out. And I took the post out after I came because it was sort of in the way in the morning. And you see, they just sat out there and looked out over that beautiful little piece of water. Now this, the hyacinths, of course, have just been dropped in here from somewhere. Just recently.
You know, you could be driving along and Richard would just go into ecstasies over some ducks. Look at that, he'd say. And we'd all think, oh, it's something, you know, what in the world is this? And we'd look out and there's some ducks flying over.
Yeah.
There was never anything he saw any more beautiful than ducks.
Didn't take much to please him.
He just loved it. Looks like he's in a cheese.
You want some more tea, Sam?
There was some cheese in there. At least I wrapped up some last night and put back in there. It's low and it's wrapped up in this. I haven't put anything back where you put it, but it's Unless the boys got into it this morning, it's just a little piece.
No, they haven't.
That's it. Because they left it out and it was quite soft when we came home and I wrapped it out and put it back in. I think that's it. This is it.
Finger?
No, it's just a little scratch.
I tell you, somebody who, you know, does things as much as Richard and, you know, is as direct as his directions are clear. By rights, you know, he ought to be able to associate with not other people like himself or in other fields, but you see, it's the point of view that changes. You can carry over the same faculties, but it's the point of view. And that's what's hard to change. But I guess that's hard to do for many of them. I have a feeling Richard could do that very easily. I mean, you know, he'd take to it. But so many of them resist that. If I got no getting into it. Now, you take that little thing I read to you last night. That's from the Boys at Home Act. Right. I don't guess you could find anybody who would read the Poetry's Almanac and didn't say, well, it's all perfectly clear. But it's not. You see, the whole point of view is a closed book.
Well, I read lots of things like that, and I don't quite understand them, and I always have the feeling.
Yeah, I'm not talking about you now. I'm talking about people who have a certain direction, competent. But they share the point of view. I just say that because I have some access to that. See, but very few people. This business, you see, about the species, Roger Karras, and the man you talked about up there. See, it's not information, it's a sort of way of life. And you can enter it with a little help. But it takes a good long while. And anyone who, you know, who does as much as you all do, he's sort of entitled to a little, you know, a little access to those things. I don't think the museum people and the art critics and people like that, I don't think they have any, I don't think they help you get into it. If anything, they sort of get you on the wrong track.
A lot of it is superficial. It's just something they read out of a book themselves, you know.
Well, I can sit and look at a beautiful sky and enjoy a duck or a pheasant or things like that. But I can't put it into words to make someone else enjoy it. Like you can, or like I could, or like Richard could.
Well, I think you've been doing...
I'm not gifted with words. Don't put me in that.
Ruth's been doing one of the most beautiful jobs of reporting this morning that I've heard.
Yeah.
You've picked up every cue, and you reported clearly. Well, you'd be surprised how many people can't tell anything.
They don't tell anything.
They just clam up.
Yeah, and see, everything he says has direction, and it's not heavy.
No, and she gives cases. She can tell what Richard saw, what Richard did, or what she did. It's a gift. Oh, it is a surprise. Suzanne Fred, I imagine this is Nell Fred.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Suzanne Whiston says,
to Suvan this morning.
Oh, this morning.
Uh-huh, this morning. Yeah, they both got students, fall students. And it was, I was telling, Suzanne was telling me that she went in to, she's going to have an assistantship this next year. She's in graduate school. She went in and she told the head of the department that she'd teach anything he told her that he could teach, just so long as she had the period open where Dr. Miles had his class, because she intended to audit it.
just come in and sit around, isn't that nice?
And I was saying, guy has to do is sit, look up and see those big old brown eyes.
Yeah. You never have to tell her anything twice. Is this it?
Yeah.
A long time.
I want it. I want everybody. What time did you say it was? It's brown bread, I guess. It's brown bread, but it's
gingerbread.
No.
Isn't it?
It doesn't have any ginger in it, but it's so moist. I want you to taste it.
Well, cream cheese would be so good on it.
I make it brown bread, but it doesn't ever turn out as. And little pear preserves that Joe brought us. Well, we're just eating on the side of the land. Laura, Joe.
Yeah. This is what I miss. I love them. Things that they just don't do until, I mean, you know, if you make something and you take somebody part of it, you know, that not everybody. There's, I'm being unfair, but there are an awful lot of people who would resent.
Oh, really?
You know, certainly. In other
no
words,
practice,
I can buy
Tiny.
My own.
Because then we...
Now, what is that about telling them? They don't want you to bring them things?
No, their feeling would be, you know, I could buy my own or make my own or, you know, or what does she want? She's bringing me a piece
yes.
of cake. Now, what
yes.
does she want me to do?
There's some motive for it.
There's no neighbor.
Some years ago, when we moved to Pelham, this friend that lives right up the street, they have a beautiful Williamsburg house. Really, everything about it is, and it's filled with beautiful antiques. And she said something about, oh, I don't know why my reputation, what people talk about when they talk about me is cooking. I wish they'd talk about me in some other, I can't seem to get away from the cooking. But she said that someone had told her one time that I made the best pecan pie. And she wished someday I'd make a pecan pie for Bill. That had been several years ago. Well, one day Richard, when Richard was at home, and I just had to be busy doing something, so somebody had sent some pecans from down south, and so I made two pecan pies, one hoping Richard would eat some, and one to take up to Charlotte and Bill. So I just drove up and honked the horn, and she came out, and I said, Charlotte, I made pecan pie for you. And she just never, I got the nicest note from her, that how in the middle of all of my sorrow I could stop and take time to make a pecan pie and such, you know, a delicious one, and really was appreciative of it. But an awful lot of people would be, and never in her mind would she think that I had done it for any reason except that I just wanted to do it. And, but most people don't do that, and I miss that because we used to do that a lot in Nashville.
Do you think they were a little more civilized than Nashville?
They were then, but I think it's changed
a
good bit now.
Well, what is that, the labor union movement?
I don't really know.
But it's changed all over. Now, we find it here. In the area, it depends upon your friends. We've got, as Jean Herbert says, it depends upon whether or not your friends are warm-hearted.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some warm-hearted friends. Some way, somehow, there are always a few who just can't do too much.
Well, I used to not be able to do too many things like that because I didn't have anywhere to get the things to where they needed to go because I didn't have a car, and I couldn't just call a taxi all the time. Richard used to always just give me enough money for, you know, groceries.
Mm-hmm. And if anything special came up, lots of times I wouldn't have any money at all. Until the next time he decided to give me some money. And so I couldn't just call a taxi because I wanted to take half of an inch of cake over to somebody, you know, over on the other side of town. Yeah. And if you're going to give them something, you don't call them up and tell them to come get it. So I, lots of times, or if they're...
Meet them halfway.
Well, I used to do that before I was sick, but now I have to conserve that extra energy, so I don't do a lot of things that I used to do.
What energy is it you have to conserve, Rufus? Your walking energy?
I just tire so quickly, guys.
Is that it?
I can't do very much.
Yes. Well, you can cook a good bit. You don't tire cooking.
I do tire.
Cooking?
I'm Dickie Cook.
Well, you talk all right, so you don't tire.
You ask me to talk. I don't normally.
I didn't ask you to talk.
You did too. You kept asking me all those questions,
I didn't ask you the question. What questions I asked you?
Look at him. He's so mean.
What did I ask, Kathleen?
For instance, you'd say, talk about Richard and you'd say, for instance. For example,
I have
Miss
the worst
Daisy's
trouble.
So good, like
I have
that.
Never been able to do it. I don't know what it is, but I do not put forth my true self to people.
What do you put forth?
I don't know.
Ruth,
I don't. I really. I am so confused about who I am and what I am.
Yeah.
Because I'm not what people think I am.
Well, what do they think you am?
I don't know.
What you am?
Oh, well, it sounds terrible, but I was starting to play the other night that...
A go-getter? I just it's a term. It's an easy term to use. They don't think you... Go ahead. Excuse me.
Well, for example, I was just starting to play that if I invited some people for lunch, I did the very best I could to make the luncheon good and to make it attractive and
yes.
to have my house clean,
yes.
to make them have a good time.
But they get the wrong idea.
But
yeah.
they get the idea that I'm trying to show off, that I'm
yes.
trying to have the best luncheon anybody's had, and I want my house to look better than anybody else's house, and that
yes.
I think I'm the best cook there is, and
yeah.
it's just not so.
Yeah.
It sure isn't just not so.
No, it
I
isn't
mean, I know it's not. I know you well enough to know that
well,
it isn't.
Well, I got
so.
Something of that impression.
That tease it. Throw that at him.
Well, you know, it's just like I called
okay.
Mr. Hamill, who's the principal of one of the schools at home.
Yeah.
And I called him because a few years back, his son was up at scout camp. And he cut his hand very badly, and there wasn't a doctor there. And Richard had just happened to go up to visit Dickie, and he took care of Tom's hand. They didn't have to take him into the hospital, which would have been hours' drive. And Richard sewed it up, and he didn't have any trouble with his hand. And Mr. Hamill was always very appreciative, and I just thought that I know Mr. Hamill, and I don't know the other principal, so I just called Mr. Hamill to ask him about the best thing to do to find out about substitute teaching, that I was planning to go back into teaching.
Yeah.
And he sort of hemmed and hawed around, you know, and he said, well, what grade did you teach? And I said, I taught the sixth grade. And he said, do you think you could handle the discipline problem or something like that? And so I said, Mr. Hamill, are you saying this because I have a soft-spoken voice, or are you saying this because you think I'm not capable?
Yes.
Oh, no, he said. I just wondered.
Yes.
And I said, I certainly think I could handle the discipline problem, and I have no doubt about being a good teacher. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm doing it because I want to do it, and I've called you because I know you better, and my husband knew you, and I felt freer to call you.
Yeah.
And I'm not asking you any favors, and I'm not asking you to hire me. I'm just asking you for some information.
Yeah.
Now, that's not my personality.
Yeah.
Now, I felt very badly that he would say to me, you know, do you think you could handle the discipline? Well, I wouldn't be going back into teaching if I didn't think I could handle the discipline. Now, I probably couldn't handle high school kids. I could if I really wanted to, but I don't want to fight the battle. I've fought enough of them, and I just don't want to.
Yeah.
But I love teaching in the lower grades, and And I prefer doing it there in Cobb because I can be at home with the children and I want to be with them as long as I can. So he called me back just before we came down here and he said, he'd be so happy to have me substitute until I got my credits and this and that. And I said, well, Mr. Hamble, I'm not going to substitute because I want to get some refresher courses and I want to find out what the new things are in teaching, and that's why I'm going to college. And I thanked him for calling me, and told him when I was qualified, I would appreciate his considering me.
Well,
but I'm not, you know, I'm not a little mealy-mouthed Southerner that people can walk all over.
You certainly are.
But I don't yell, and I don't, and I'm not a nitwit. I'm not a brain, but I'm not anybody's moron either.
Is that right? That's once and for all.
Isn't she cute? It's like she was in the ninth grade. And you never were mealy-mouthed, and you never were.
You're the only one. Is this that determination?
Well, let me tell you, Ruth, I don't know. It's sort of a constant. It's a sort of constant battle. I think the people that are misunderstood are the ones that take the responsibility.
Uh huh. If you didn't ever
take a hand.
If you never did take a hand in anything.
That's right. Just let the system take its own.
Nobody would ever question it.
I think that's where you are anachronistic. You see, you still take a little responsibility. Nobody else does.
Well, the phone rings all winter long. When there's something to be done, they'll call me. You know, and they always say, I know you're busy.
But
the busy people are the ones who do things.
Sure.
And we know if you say you do it, that it will be done, and it will be done
well. I could tell them that.
But then on the other hand, you know, they'll say, well, I can't have you to my house for lunch.
You'd be disappointed.
If I can't do it the way you do it, I don't want them to do it the way I do it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think about it.
Yeah.
And I don't begin to think that the way I do it is the best way that it can be done. I don't think that anything I do is the best that it can be done.
Well,
I don't have that feeling of positiveness about anything.
But
I'll try anything. I'll try it once.
Did you ever see a more wretched system of dishwashing than the one I pursue? You didn't answer that question. It's not a question.
I want to tell you.
You're not supposed to ask people questions.
I want to tell you one
little thing. Because most of the dishes get clean. Doesn't matter how they
are. I don't think they do.
Well, you're still living, and so.
Let me tell you one little incident about Frances, about my sister. She's one of those that, very much like you, if there's anything to be done, she gets called.
Yeah.
And she does it. If there's any entertaining to be done, would you have it at your house? And she does it. And she sees that it's clean and the flowers are in the house and all of that. And if anybody gets sick, she's the one who goes. And if any child gets in trouble, and it's always Fanny that can do something with the juvenile court. And she spends her life doing this way. And everybody says, well, Ms. Hurd, and I know that's the way it is, and tell them, I know it is, you don't have to tell me, because it's the same thing. She was down here several years ago, and of course, when we get sick, it's like when we came up to you, you know,
mm-hmm.
there, you took care of us. So when we get sick down here, the first thing we think of, well, we'll call Fanny. So she was down here several years ago, and she and Shiv were going on down south to fish. He was going to fish, and she was going along this long-suffering life with him. And when they came in, I had I don't know what made me do it. I never do things for her, but I had a ham baked.
Yeah.
And I wrapped this ham up, and I said, Fanny, take it with you. She stood at the door, and she's a very controlled person. And she stood at the door, and she cried. And she said, do you know, this is the first time anybody has ever said, here's something I've cooked for you, would you take it with you? And I couldn't believe it.
I know.
That I had taken my own sister for granted all these hundreds of years.
We know Mother and Francis and Jane used to always say to me, well, we can't do anything for you, you have everything.
Yeah, that's it.
Where they ever got that idea, I don't know.
Well, I had something, same idea.
And you see, that's the way they treat Francis. What could we take her? She's got everything.
when somebody brings me a little old pothole or something, I'm just as excited as if they'd brought me a diamond ring, because people don't usually give me anything.
Yeah.
Or even a...
I think some people like that. The ones, you know, that gifted and...
Right. Gene Herbert's like that.
That's right.
And Florence, of all the people, I want Ruth to talk to Florence. Of all the people, is one of guys' closest
friends.
Well,
she was coming over here yesterday to talk to Ruth, but you see, we had...
So I'll call her and get her over today. She's just the most marvelous person I know. And she's in the midst of moving, you know.
Well, that's
but,
I don't know how to, I don't mean
but
that I want people to be giving me things.
It's not that, but it's this thing that, and nobody.